The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're already at the last program of the week. Can you believe it? These weeks go by quicker and quicker with each passing 7 days. A lot to get to on today's program. We've touched on this theme before, but just the radical swing of the Democratic Party. You wonder how or if voters realize just how radical that party has become. They've been on full display this week. Of course, climate change is one of the most discussed topics in this 2020 Democratic primary. And I referred briefly yesterday to the 7 hours, the town hall on CNN on Wednesday. And we'll be playing a few clips from that coming up later on in this segment. Also on today's show, we'll be talking about the subject of pornography. The program that I did a few weeks ago on video game addiction, there were a couple of people that emailed in and asked if since I'm on the subject of entertainment and video games and addictions, if we'd get into the subject of pornography. So I'm going to pull together some material from some older programs that we did and update it somewhat and give you that for the last 25 minutes or so of today's program. So just a heads up for some of you parents that might be listening with little ones. There's nothing graphic in the segment at all, but in case you want to listen first and then discuss later with smaller children, that's coming up, as I say, in the second segment. A few emails coming in first, responding to yesterday's program where I talked about my mother 15 years on from her death back in 2004. This one here says, I really enjoyed listening to the bio on Mrs. Flurry on the radio program this morning. She seems like such a wonderful woman. Wish I had met her. Whenever I've heard her mentioned, it's always been her generosity or thoughtfulness or how much she loved God's people. I'm sure she was a great example to the people around her. Can't wait to meet her in a few short years. Another one here says, thank you for the beautiful segment regarding your beloved mother. It makes me wish I could have met her and known her in this physical life. Sharing personal details of her character and the home life she cultivated for your family is truly inspiring and uplifting, especially for those of us who perhaps didn't experience that kind of warmth and love growing up. Her example, recounting your memories, teaches us the impact we can have as mothers and wives. What a special gift she had for encouragement, and to still encourage all those around her while she personally struggled with her health. It says she left quite the imprint on those she came into contact with. Thank you for sharing your mother and family today with all of us. I can't wait to get to meet her in the kingdom. Another one here says, in response to yesterday's program about your mother, my husband and I were at that last service of your mother's in the field house, the one you mentioned before she had her stroke. I was waiting in line to say hi to your mom, and it was announced to find our seats. And yet right before services started, your mom came to me and gave me a hug. It was so sweet, showing her love. Can't believe it's been 15 years. Another one here, a longer one. I had to condense it down just a little bit. But it says here, this morning during the Trumpet Daily, I was listening through tears as you were talking about and praising your late mother's loving attitude and service to God, our church brethren, and her community, as you spoke of her love of people, a people person, and about her dedication to God and her care for those around her. I was flooded with some poignant, happy memories of our dearest Mrs. Barbara Flurry. Listening to you made me remember how much I miss her and of my own experiences of her uplifting care through the last 6 years or so of her life. Two times stood out most of all, and she goes on to talk about her first meeting with my mother back in 1997. It was at a singles event, and this lady had struggled coming into the PCG with some family issues and even personal issues, and she was going through a real time of discouragement. And at that time, at this singles event, my mother came up to her along with Mrs. Fraser, and both of them offered encouragement and encouraged her even to eat more. I guess she was struggling with her health at the time. This listener said that following that conversation with these two ladies, she really came through with a lot more zeal and excitement for God's work. Her focus was realigned. It says, several years later, during another singles event, the singles event you spoke of, just before Mrs. Fleury suffered her stroke, I saw her as she was walking out of the field house after one of the events, and I ran outside to her and thanked her for her help those years ago, explaining how much she had helped me go forward. It says, with a brilliant smile, she hugged me outside under the moon and told me she was so pleased with the progress I had been making in building character and tending the children with God's help. And she said to just keep going and never ever leave God and his way of living, the give way. She told me to keep obeying God, keep God's promises about our future in mind, and how we have to take care of one another because we're the family of God. I promised her I would remember, and have been striving ever since with God's help to follow her example and her instruction by paying forward her example of God's love to me that day and all other days after. It says, finally, your mother was a tremendous encouragement, always lovingly serving and uplifting and encouraging those around her. She worked hard to be aware of needs and to take care of those around her. Today, years later, I often hear brethren still talking of how they miss her and their own experiences of her help and encouragement. This comes from my sister, and she's writing here to her nieces and nephews. She says, hello, kiddos. Just thought you might want to know that your grandmother died on September 5th, 2004, 15 years ago today. She was writing this yesterday, and she said, Uncle Stephen mentioned it on his program today. Just think, we'll see her in just a few short years. So if you'd like to listen to that segment that we produced yesterday about my mother, that's at thetrumpet.com under the title, She Had the Gift of Encouragement. Well, we've been talking all through this week about the political division in the UK and the desperate attempt by Labour and other enemies of Boris Johnson to bring down his government, to delay Brexit. They're refusing Johnson's request for snap elections. And he is basically going straight to the people, as you can see from this this next clip. He posted a video yesterday just summarizing the events of this week and calling upon the people of Britain to demand that their MPs go ahead and follow through on this new election request. Here's what Mr. Johnson had to say to the people of Britain yesterday. Clip 9.
I've been negotiating over the past 5 weeks to get us a new deal. EU leaders were willing to negotiate a deal because they knew we're going to leave on October the 31st, deal or no deal. Last night, Jeremy Corbyn and others voted to wreck the chance of a deal. Their new law tries to force the government to go to Brussels, beg for another delay until 2020, or for as long as Brussels demands. People don't want another pointless delay, but this law is even worse. Brussels could demand that I hand over billions of your money in return for this pointless delay, and I refuse to do this. My view is that if Parliament tries to force another pointless delay, and I refuse to do that, then voters should decide what happens next. And people can choose. Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister, go to Brussels on the 17th of October to delay Brexit again and do what Brussels wants. Or people can choose me to go to Brussels on the 17th of October, try to negotiate a new deal, and I'm confident that I can, but to leave on the 31st of October in all circumstances so that the country can move on. Last night, Jeremy Corbyn voted to stop you, the public, deciding this. He's now voted to destroy the negotiations, to delay again for no reason, and to stop you deciding whether we delay or not. It seems to me he doesn't trust you to make this decision. I do trust you. It will be totally wrong for Parliament to force another pointless delay without your agreement.
That's Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Yesterday, if you're watching the YouTube stream, you saw his famously disheveled hair. Not unlike, although I think President Trump at least has it looking nicer day in and day out. But they both have pretty big hairdos, I suppose. And they both are appealing to the people, directly to the people. And so he's calling upon the people of Britain to apply pressure on their MPs to go forward on Monday and to let the people of Britain settle this dispute. The latest from Sky News this morning, it says the PM not willing to consider Brexit not happening on the 31st of October. I think he was quoted yesterday or in another speech. He said that he would rather be dead in a ditch than to delay Brexit beyond October 31st. And again, he's going against his opponents in politics and, of course, the major media. His brother, who was an MP in Parliament, he resigned yesterday. So the media, they're making a big deal out of that as well. Anything and everything they can to bring him down. Sky News says, asked if can't deliver a Brexit on the 31st, whether he would resign. The Prime Minister says that's not a hypothesis I'm willing to contemplate. I want us to get this thing done. And I think the people of this country also do. There's an opportunity to be so much more positive about this. I still think there's so much negativity around about this country, about what it can do, and about Brexit. Mr. Johnson said, finally, I'm looking forward to a Britain where we no longer wrangle about how exactly we're going to come out of the EU. His point is, well, what's the point? We're paying like £1 billion a month to stay in. Why should we keep delaying? If we're on the way out, let's get out. Let's make the break. The people have spoken. It's been 3 years. Corbyn and his friends in Parliament, they want to see it delayed into 2020 now. And they also are worried that if there are fresh elections in mid-October, they'll worry that they are worried that they'll lose. So it should be an interesting week next week. Richard Palmer, our UK correspondent, he'll be back from vacation, so I'm sure he'll have lots of he'll be busy with the news gathering come Monday morning, and we'll update you on the very latest. Well, as I said at the top of the segment, the extreme views of the radical left and the Democratic Party, it's been on display this week. CNN has done everything possible to amplify the message coming from the radical left. Climate change, as I say, that's been one of the most discussed issues. You listen to these Democrats running for president, and you would think that climate change is right at the forefront or right at the top of the to-do list for every ordinary American. And I don't think it's like that at all. But here they are coming out declaring their full support for the Green New Deal. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she released that plan a few months back, and it was just ridiculed and mocked in so many circles, and yet they're all on board with it. They're all on board with it. As I said, Wednesday night, CNN hosted this 7 hours That's how long the town hall went on. And the focus of the whole afternoon and evening was climate change. Grabian, the outfit we look to for so many of our clips, they put together a montage yesterday. Some of the highlights, or lowlights, I guess, depending on how you look at it, from that, I guess it wasn't a debate on Wednesday, but more of a town hall setting. But here's what Grabian pulled together, clip one.
Would you support changing the dietary guidelines?
Yes.
The food pyramid, but people
yes.
are
like, yes.
to reduce red meat specifically.
Yes, I would.
Do you ban plastic straws?
I think we should. Yes.
So would you ban offshore drilling?
Yes.
Just today, the Trump administration announced plans to overturn requirements on energy-saving light bulbs. Would you reinstate those requirements as president?
If you can get electricity from a light bulb that utilizes one-tenth of the power that an old incandescent light bulb used, of course you're going to do that.
We have to take combustion engine vehicles off the road as rapidly as we can.
Educating everyone on the need to curb population growth seems a reasonable campaign to enact. Would you be courageous enough to discuss this issue and make it a key feature of a plan to address climate catastrophe?
Well, Martha, the answer is yes. I think especially in poor countries around the world where women do not necessarily want to have large numbers of babies and where they can have the opportunity through birth control to control the number of kids they have, something I very, very strongly support.
Let's talk about offshore drilling for oil. Would you ban it?
Yes.
Would you ban offshore drilling? Absolutely yes. We will transition off of fossil fuels, natural gas, coal, oil.
What about the export of fossil fuels from the United States? Would you ban that?
Absolutely, we must get to that point.
There's no question I'm in favor of banning fracking.
I'm in favor of a carbon-free America.
In my administration, we're not going to build any new nuclear power plants.
We should set out the rules for what kind of plant, coal-burning plants. No one's going to build another coal-burning. We've got to shut the ones down we have.
We're going to end factory farming because that is not only, that is a danger to the environment and to climate change. You know, there will be a transition. There will be a transition, and there will be some pain there.
This is not a skit from Saturday Night Live. This is real. They're serious about all of these things. One ban after another. As one conservative blog put it, say goodbye to freedom and prosperity. Say goodbye. Here again, do voters really and truly realize just how extreme the views of the Democrat Party are right about now? And as I say, CNN puts it out there on a platform as if this is all that Americans are concerned about. Just so that you know, Wednesday night, Fox News won in the ratings. MSNBC nearly doubled CNN. And so CNN's way down at the bottom with this seven-hour marathon. So here they are. They're attacking coal mining, fossil fuels. They're going to get rid of plastic straws. There's a clip later about cheeseburgers. How are Americans going to react to this next year? You have to imagine the Trump re-election campaign just absolutely salivating over the sound bites they're able to pull from this party just this week. Think of the attack ads a year from now. Coal mining, fossil fuels. Their plan is to do away with some of the largest sources of energy in the United States in order to save the environment. Coal-fueled power plants provide 27% of the electricity for Americans. And you know what's incredible to me? I can't remember where I saw this yesterday, but, maybe it was the Daily Caller. But Hillary Clinton, you know, after her disastrous run in 2016, everybody thought she would win, and then she gets to the end of the road and writes the tell-all book. I think the title was What Happened? A lot of people were wondering, what happened? How did you lose it? How could you not win against Donald Trump? And so she comes out with the book. And in her book, Hillary Clinton identified the comment that she regretted the most during the presidential campaign of 2016. What do you suppose it is that she regretted the most? Well, here it is, clip two.
I'm the only candidate which has a policy about how to bring economic opportunity using clean, renewable energy as the key into coal country, because we're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business.
We're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business. And that, she said later, is what I regret most. That was worse in her mind than the deplorables comment. That was the worst because it hurt her. She lost every county in West Virginia. Coal mining country. That was just 3 years ago. This was what her campaign spokeswoman said right after she made that comment in 2016. Here's what her spokeswoman came out to say. Clip three.
She wasn't very clear about how she said that.
Very clear about how she said that. They started backtracking immediately, and even CNN at the time provided cover. There was one host on CNN that said, well, you know, even if that's what she believes, should she really have said that? Because that's not really going to fly with a lot of Americans in coal mining countries in the so-called Rust Belt. CNN 3 years ago was saying maybe she shouldn't say that. CNN 2 days ago, well, you heard them. What about straws? You going to ban straws? What about coal? You going to ban coal? What about offshore drilling? Going to ban that? Ban, ban, ban. You know, that's interesting, too. What would they say? How would they react if a president like Donald Trump came out and said, I'm going to ban this, I'm going to ban this, I'm going to ban this? They in the final analysis, if it's someone on their side, they prefer a dictator type. They want someone with a strong hand that's going to come in and do away with all these fossil fuels. If it fits with their agenda, they're quite happy for a strong arm in the White House. Pete Buttigieg, he was one of the, I think it's 10 that they had featured on Wednesday. But listen to what he said on Wednesday about straws and eating cheeseburgers. This is clip four.
See, right now we're in a mode where we're, I think we're thinking about it mostly through the perspective of guilt, you know, from using a straw to eating a burger. Am I part of the problem? In a certain way, yes, but the most exciting thing is that we can all be part of the solution.
If you use straws or you're eating a burger, you're part of the problem, he said. Part of the problem. In the second quarter, according to tax filings, he, as you'll hear here in a moment, his campaign spent $300,000 on private air travel, flying rather on a private jet. And I think it's Chris Cuomo in this clip. He asked him about that apparent contradiction. Clip five.
Air travel is about 2% of green house gas emissions. The number of travelers obviously going up around the world. Private air travel, therefore, even worse because it serves a smaller population. Your second quarter filing says your campaign spent about $300,000 on private filing. You're going to get the finger shaken at you that look, you should not be doing that if you're going to be the green guy.
Look, I'm interested in decarbonizing the fuel that goes into air travel.
So he flies on private jets, but he's, I guess his answer to that is he's going to decarbonize the fuel that goes into that goes into planes. So he's not quite as extreme as AOC on eliminating air travel altogether. But here they are offering all of these sound bites, these juicy sound bites for the Trump reelection campaign. You'll be hearing some of those same statements from Wednesday. You'll be hearing them again next year, as Legal Insurrection said. CNN's seven-hour climate change town hall was a man-made disaster for Democrat presidential candidates. A man-made disaster. It says the presidential ambitions of the leading Democrat candidates may not survive CNN's seven-hour climate change town hall. It was a man-made disaster created in the fevered swamps of CNN and fueled by pledges of allegiance to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal. As they say over at Legal Insurrection, it's AOC's party now. It's definitely her party. They are disciples of this young gal who's been in Congress for a year. She's in her 20s. She's been there a year or so. And they are her disciples. This is her party. If you just step back and, well, even considering what Hillary Clinton said just a couple years ago following her loss to Donald Trump, you could almost make the case that there's Donald Trump operatives working at CNN. Yeah, 7 hours. Let's do 7 hours of it. Climate change. 7 hours of climate change. How about that? Well, actually, you got to the end of the, actually, let's bump ahead, Dwight, to the, what is it, clip eight. You get to the end of the 7 hour town hall, and this is what Don Lemon announced at the end of his segment, clip eight.
Listen to this. CNN is partnering with the Human Rights Campaign Foundation for our next series of presidential town halls on issues that are important to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community. So make sure you tune into that. That's going to be next month. It'll be in Los Angeles.
So that's what we've got coming up next month. Lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual, queer. I'm assuming it's another 7 hour marathon. 7 hours. And they think this is right at the top of the agenda for average Americans, for ordinary Americans. Now, I'm sure the other side, Donald Trump, would probably have things to say, but just the, on those issues, I mean, that's just the age we're living in. But 7 hours of climate change, and now 7 more hours, presumably, on queer topics. This is CNN. And then you can, together with all of this, you have the Trump derangement syndrome. I can't even believe, with all of the email alerts from Grabian, how many clips there are about Sharpie Gate, the Sharpie pen that President Trump may have used on one of these maps of the hurricane. And of course, it's changed dramatically. They always do. But he gets up, I guess it was on Sunday when he tweets out that, you know, this is a threat to not just Florida, but also Georgia and Alabama. And then the National Weather Service tweets out, I guess, a half hour later saying Alabama is not going to be impacted by this. And so it's been back and forth between the president and his opponents. This is what he had to say on Wednesday, I think it was, clip six.
And we got lucky in Florida, very, very lucky indeed. We had actually our original chart was that it was going to be hitting Florida directly. That was what was originally projected. And it took a right turn. And ultimately, hopefully, we're going to be lucky. It depends on what happens with South Carolina and North Carolina.
So that's what he said on Wednesday. He showed the original projection that it was going to just plow through Florida and then continue on to Alabama. So he showed the projection, and then there's this black line extending the projection that kind of edges into Alabama. And, of course, the Democrats, the media, they say, well, who wrote on that map? Who could have done that? This is what a reporter asked him, clip seven.
You showed us the map earlier, the initial forecast of it. It appeared to have been, I guess, edited or something to include Alabama. Can you explain how that change was made?
I know that Alabama was in the original forecast. They thought it would get it as a piece of it. It was supposed to go. Actually, we have a better map than that, which is going to be presented, where we had many lines going directly, many models, each line being a model. And they were going directly through. And in all cases, Alabama was hit, if not lightly, in some cases, pretty hard.
And so it's been back and forth now. And I mean, even on President Trump's side, it's something that he should just drop and move on from. But he's accusing them of fake news. And fake news is coming back and saying, you doctored this. It's yet another example in their minds of a lie. There was even, I think it was in the Washington Post, someone that said that what the president might have done there in opposition to the National Weather Service was illegal. He might be guilty of a crime here. Well, Wednesday, this is from Newsbusters, CNN and MSNBC, they gave this non-news item 145 minutes of coverage. That's just on one day. CNN, of course, had the seven-hour marathon going on, but they found time to squeeze in Sharpiegate. 145 minutes. And meanwhile, you have all these hotspots in the world. Brexit, for example. The division in UK. Hardly any coverage. Again, as I said earlier, you have to wonder if there's some Trump operatives working at CNN or some of these agencies, because it seems so much like they're just actually helping him to get reelected. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll ask, is pornography harmful? We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert Armstrong often said it was more difficult to unlearn an erroneous supposed truth than it is to learn a new truth. Even after 58 years of faithfully serving God, he had not fully and clearly realized the significance of the fact revealed in Genesis 3, 22-24, that, in fact, God had closed the Holy Spirit and eternal life to mankind in general until the removal of Satan at the second coming of Jesus Christ. Traditional Christian teaching has always assumed there is a contest between God and Satan, that God has been trying desperately to get the world saved. In other words, God had sent Jesus Christ at his first coming to try to win this ongoing war against Satan. Traditional Christianity has taught that whosoever will may come and be saved through Jesus. For many years, Mr. Armstrong partially realized the error of this assumption, but the full truth on this point did not come crystal clear to his mind until the last few years of his life. This truth, fully explained in Mystery of the Ages, is indeed mind-boggling. This book clears what has been fully clouded in mystery. It will open your eyes to the truth of these long-hidden mysteries. This enlightening volume thoroughly explains precisely what the Bible says about the seven great mysteries of life. It is free upon request. For more, visit thetrumpet.com.
Trumpet Daily.
People are looking at lots of pornography. A recent ranking puts four pornography sites among the top 25 websites in the entire world. The most popular pornography website has more than 3 billion visits per month, more than Instagram, Amazon, or Netflix. And the other top sites, like Google, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Bing, Yahoo, Netflix, they're also serving enormous amounts of semi-pornographic images and videos. Even news sites, including some conservative ones, often feature celebrity news on the front page as an excuse to feature sexualized images. A large percentage of advertisements also feature images of partially unclothed women. Sexually explicit content is so common that some high schools now teach students how to view it in a healthy way. The New York Times reported last year that some students as young as 15 in Massachusetts have been taking porn literacy classes. This is happening in high school. This is an article from February 7th, 2018. What teenagers are learning from online porn for 2 hours a week over a five-week period, about two dozen students. These are teenagers, keep in mind. They took part in the class, which is neither anti-porn nor pro-porn. That's according to the Boston Public Health Commission. The Times said the class aims to make them savvier, more critical consumers of porn by examining how gender, sexuality, aggression, consent, race, queer sex, relationship, and body images are portrayed in porn. So this is what passes for education today. So many young people now view sexual photos and videos so often that some teachers believe they should help students view it more responsibly. The thought is pornography may have its dangers, but if state education boards are involved, then children can be taught to consume it in a healthy way. The porn literacy course is grounded in the reality that most adolescents do see porn. That's what the Times had to say. And it takes the approach that teaching them, the teens, to analyze its messages is far more effective than simply wishing our children could live in a porn-free world. So they're basically giving in. It's a defeatist approach. And it legitimizes child sex activity. And this is a message that's, well, it's all too familiar. We hear it over and over again. Educators surrendering, parents surrendering. I can remember back in the 1990s when some educators at that time were saying that children in high school, well, they're all having sexual intercourse. Everyone's doing it. And so we can't teach abstinence if they're all sexually active. We have to teach them how to have sex in a safe way. And so we have to make birth control available. That was in the 1990s. Now we've moved on to teaching children how to view porn responsibly, of all things. Responsibly. The Times wrote about how porn distributors make it incredibly easy for minors to access porn. It says the mainstream websites aren't verifying your age, and your phone allows you to watch porn away from the scrutinizing eyes of adults. If you still have parental control filters, you probably have ways around them. That's from the Times article last year. The reasoning is that, well, children are going to find a way to get to the content one way or another. Parents should just accept the reality. Why not incorporate it into the high school curriculum? What this is an unconditional surrender to satanic debauchery, a total surrender to the devil. Parents aren't teaching their children about love and marriage and sex. So they're beginning to leave it to pornography, of all things, and porn literacy class. The Times, in that article, reported that sex educators have even created a porn education website for parents. So there's a website for parents now, a porn education website. One of the website's primary creators is a feminist producer of pornography. She said this, "We've given our children technology, so we need to teach them how to handle it." She even suggested that parents should give their children healthy porn, as she called it. And so in this article, she was asked, well, do you take the same approach with your own daughters? And here's how the feminist responded. She said, "I would recommend good sites to my daughters at age 15 when I think that they're mature enough." She said, "We're so curious to find out about sex. People have doubts and insecurities about themselves sexually. Is it okay that I like this or this? She said, I think porn, this is a mother talking. She said, I think porn can be a good thing to have as an outlet. I'm not scared by explicit sex per se. I'm afraid of the bad values. She's not scared of explicit sex scenes or her teenagers viewing them. But what she is afraid of is bad values. This reminds me of something we've been covering in my Principles of Living class here at the college. We're going through Alan Bloom's classic from 1987, The Closing of the American Mind. And this is a quote from Professor Bloom. He said, intractable good, he's talking about moral relativism in this section, and he says, intractable good and evil cause infinite distress, like war and sexual repression, which is almost instantly relieved when more flexible values are introduced. Bloom says one need not feel bad about or uncomfortable with oneself when just a little value adjustment is necessary. So if you're feeling guilty, if you're ashamed, then just make a little value adjustment and say that, well, actually, this thing that's wrong, it's not so bad after all. It's actually kind of good. There's a responsible way to approach this, or a healthy way to view pornography. In No Freedom Without Law, my father said, deep down, we know that pornography is evil. In the past, even the thought of it caused us shame. At one time, we also declared a war on pornography. But we don't hear much about that war anymore. Why? Because we don't like admitting defeat. We don't like admitting that we've surrendered. As Professor Bloom noted, why should we admit defeat? Or why should we feel guilty or be ashamed when all you need to do to fix it is just make a little value adjustment? In the September 2017 issue of Wired magazine, Sarah Fallon wondered how she should bring up her two sons in a porn culture. She interviewed this author, Peggy Orenstein, who is currently working on a book about boys, masculinity, sex, love, and yes, porn, Fallon wrote. Orenstein told Fallon, she said, the first thing I recognized when I started working on the new book was that the question to ask boys is not whether or if they watch porn. The question is, when was the first time you saw it? Here again, total surrender. You go in knowing that they're going to view it. So that's how that we have to approach it now. They had this conversation in this article. As I say, it's Wired magazine from 2017. It kind of bounced between the pros and cons of pornography, as if there are pros. And then it eventually ended with this comment from Orenstein. She's the one working on this book. She said, the biggest surprise for me as a parent has been how hard we now have to work to protect our kids' imaginations from predatory, addictive websites that want to sell things to them or sell them to advertisers. So you have to lay the groundwork to have conversations about what's real and what's not. Talk about how when you see a movie, there's violence, but the violence is totally unrealistic. She says, porn is really only the extreme end of an issue. We know these things are fake. That's not the way two people really interact. Kids have to be able to contextualize, to deconstruct it, just like they need to do with other forms of media. It says the best advice the so-called authorities can offer parents is to accept that your children will see pornography. Just make sure they understand it is the extreme and it is not real life. It's just like watching an action movie. There may be some benefits from it too, she says. The best advice is to just accept that your children will see pornography. Just make sure they understand that it's not real. It's not how two people really interact. It's sort of like watching an action movie. You know there's violence, but it's not real. You're not going to go out and do that like they do it on the movies. That's what the educators today are advising our children, or that's the advice that they're giving to them, when in fact there are zero benefits and huge consequences for boys and young men and older men, for that matter, who consume addictive pornographic filth that reduces women to objects, weakens the will of men, robs them of true masculinity, destroys marriages and families, and gives children a twisted and perverted view of the God-ordained purposes for marriage and sex. Who's even sounding the alarm anymore about the great damage caused by pornography? You just don't hear it. Nobody even talks about it. There was an article, I guess it's going on 2 years now, a laugh out loud article, at least when you skim through the content. It was by The Atlantic's Matt Kessler. And he's writing about pornography in December 2017. And he was alarmed by the negative impact of streaming billions of pornographic videos. He was alarmed by it. Why? Well, he wasn't alarmed by the direct destructive effects on millions of minds. He was alarmed by the indirect, the way he views it, the indirect destructive effects on the environment. In other words, there's all these billions and billions of downloads. That's taking a lot of energy, a lot of electricity and such. And what kind of impact is this having on the environment, of all things? Here, pornography is the most popular content on the internet, and The Atlantic's main concern is about its impact on carbon footprints, climate change. No one, not anymore anyway, no one seems to care about how this avalanche of filth is destroying our marriages and our children. People are just accepting it now. And some are even calling it good. An appalling 36% of Americans now believe that viewing pornography is moral. They believe it's right to do. That's 36%. That's more than a third of Americans. Here we are. We think we can redefine the traditional family and biblical morality and avoid the dreadful consequences of sin. But God says there's a cause and effect. And the effects of our sinful living, they are there for everyone to see if our eyes are just open to it. God says, "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." That's in Isaiah 5 and verse 20. And then over in Isaiah 29 and verse 15 and 16, the prophet again says that we're turning things upside down. And we're calling evil good. And the reason for that, I've kind of touched on it already with the Alan Bloom quote, but the reason for that is that human nature desperately wants to be considered good. We want to think of ourselves as good and righteous. So that's why we're making so many value adjustments. Well, hey, I don't want to feel guilty. I don't want to be ashamed. So I want to make an adjustment here so that I can say, actually, you know, this is good. This is moral. God says these days are evil. You can read about that in 2 Timothy 3. He says our nations are terminally ill or sick. The whole head is sick, Isaiah said. The whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot, even unto the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. That's in Isaiah 1. God is saying that America is decaying because of its rotten morals, because of this filth, because of this sexual perversion, this deviance. and no one can offer a sound solution. The only one that sounds the alarm, or one of them, he's concerned about the environment. Here our nation is. It's glorifying the use of pornography. And here we are spewing it, this filth, all over the world. Isaiah 3 says that we're declaring our sin as Sodom. In the book of Ezekiel, we have a booklet on this, Ezekiel the end time prophet. But in the book, this is in chapter 24, God likens the sins of our nations to scum. And my father writes about this in the booklet, saying that God says our sins is like rust or green corrosion. It clings to our people, and it seems you can't get it off unless you burn it off. That's indeed what God will do if they don't heed this message. That's from the Ezekiel, the end time prophet booklet. If you want to study this more, you can look at chapter 11 of that booklet. You can get a free copy of that on our website. But that's God's perspective. Even secular history offers a thunderous warning for us today. Historian Edward Gibbon, we refer to him and even assign some of his history in our college classes here at AC. He said that the root cause for the collapse of the Roman Empire was their loss of civic virtue and individual morality. This is how Rome fell. Gibbon believed the laws of morality were as constant as the laws of mathematics and physics. Who believes this today, though? Most people today believe that our societies are just too sophisticated, modern, and enlightened to collapse under the weight of what God defines as sin and immorality. We do well to heed the warnings of the past. It's been said before, if we fail to learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. But really, the only thing we seem to learn from history, if you can even say it that way, is that we never seem to learn from it. We just keep making the same mistakes. We're going the way of Rome. We're going the way of Sodom. And we're proud of it. Well, that's the way of our nations, but there is hope for individuals willing to humble themselves before the mighty hand of God, as Peter said in his masterpiece, The Missing Dimension in Sex. 20th century educator Herbert W. Armstrong, he said this: sex was designed and created in humans for purposes other than reproduction, for purposes totally foreign to animal or plant life. But the world has continued in unhappy and wretched ignorance of these glorious and God-bestowed purposes. That's from Missing Dimension in Sex. The reason our culture is so confused when it comes to the subject of sex is because it has rejected the creator of sex and what he teaches in the Bible. My father gave a program back in December of 2017. This is 2 years on now. 2 years ago. When he explained the divine purposes of sex as defined in the Bible, he also on this program, he pointed out why society has it so backwards. Here's what my father said from December 2017.
But if you look at educators and scientists and psychologists today, they talk about moral standards and all of that, but they believe in evolution. They do not know the origin and purposes of sex. They don't know the origin of marriage. They do not know. Well, it's very clear if you believe the Bible. But if you reject the Bible, well, you're just relying on human reasoning. And that's going to bring you disaster. That's good. That's what's bringing this world disaster. And our number one problem today is that of human survival, because we're relying on the human mind and not God's thinking.
There's a reason God made us male and female and then ordained the instructions or institutions of marriage and family. There's a reason for all of this. Mr. Armstrong's book, I quoted from this book a moment ago, Missing Dimension in Sex, but it's all based, the content of that book, it's based on the biblical morality. It's the best teaching tool any parent could ever use to educate their children about love, marriage, and sex. Use that book. Use Mr. Armstrong's book, along with the Bible, to understand the incredible purpose that God's working out here below. If you apply that material in MDS, it'll bring fathomless joy and meaning into your marriage and into your family, into the lives of your children. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. For more information on the subject we covered here in this segment, go to the trumpet.com website and look for Joel Hilliker's article. I think this is from 2004. It's titled Porn Free. Porn Free. That's at the trumpet.com website. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us all week, and we'll see you next week.